When trying to solve a problem, many Christians ask themselves, what would Jesus do? Well, that question is now at the center of a fierce debate about the economy, with conservatives promoting a small government Jesus and liberals seeing Jesus as an advocate of more programs to help the poor. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
After the House passed its budget last month, liberal religious leaders said the Republican plan, which lowered taxes and cut services to the poor, was an affront to the gospel and especially Jesus' command to care for the poor. Not so, says Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan, who chairs the House Budget Committee. He recently told Christian Broadcasting Network that it was his Catholic faith that helped shape the budget plan. In his view, the Catholic principle of subsidiarity suggests the government should have little role in helping the poor.
Through our civic organizations, through our churches, through our charities, through all of our different groups where we interact with people as a community, that's how we advance the common good.
The best thing that government can do, he said, is get out of the way.
I think that he's completely missing the boat and not understanding the real heart, the real core of Catholic social teaching.
That's Stephen Schneck, a political scientist at Catholic University. He says Catholicism sees everyone as part of a mystical body that serves one another. True, the New Testament does not specifically speak to the government's role.
But charities and individuals and churches can't do it all. When charities are already stretched to their limit, Catholic social teaching expects the state to step up and to fill that gap.
Peter Montgomery at People for the American Way says conservative evangelicals have been arguing for years that the Bible favors a free market system. But since Barack Obama was elected, he says, they've shifted into high gear.
They are finding biblical justification for opposition to progressive taxation, opposition to unions and collective bargaining, oppositions to the minimum wage, opposition even to social welfare spending and social security.
Because, in their view, he says, God intends the government to have a minimal role in society. You heard echoes of that from megachurch pastor Rick Warren, who was asked about the budget recently on ABC's This Week.
The primary purpose of government is to keep the peace, protect the citizens, provide opportunity. And when we start getting into all kinds of other things, I think we invite greater control. And I'm fundamentally about freedom.
Evangelicals cite the book of Romans, which is one of the few places in the New Testament that refers to civil government. Then there's the conservative resistance to taxation, which some say violates the Eighth Commandment, thou shalt not steal. Richard Land at the Southern Baptist Convention says, of course, Jesus paid his taxes and advised followers to do the same. But he says,
the Bible tells us that socialism and neo-socialism never work. Confiscatory tax rates never work.
The Bible never mentions socialism, obviously, but Land says the whole of Scripture says that people are sinful and selfish, and therefore,
people aren't going to work very hard and very productively unless they get to keep a substantial portion of that which they make for them and for their families.
For other religious conservatives, the Bible is a blueprint for a robust capitalism. Recently, on his radio program Wall Builders, David Barton and a guest discussed Jesus' parable of the vineyard owner. In it, the owner pays the worker he hires at the end of the day the same wage as he pays the one who begins work in the morning. Many theologians have long interpreted this as God's grace being available right up to the last minute, but Barton sees the parable as a bar to collective bargaining.
Where were unions in all this? The contract is between an employer and an employee.
Individual
it's not between
relationship.
A group. He went out and hired individually the guys he wanted to work.
Stephen Schneck at Catholic University says many Christians would not recognize this gospel, and he says there are more biblical verses about feeding the hungry and taking care of the least of these. Schneck agrees that the Bible encourages initiative and hard work, but he says theologians through the ages have said there must be a balance.
Pope after pope after pope argued that we're called to be more than market creatures. We're called, in fact, to always bear in mind the common good and our responsibilities to others.
We can probably expect both parties to claim Jesus as their favorite economist in the months to come. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
We're going to hear now from a religious leader revered by Tibetan Buddhists and admired by countless others, the 14th Dalai Lama. A year ago, he stepped down as the political leader of Tibet's government in exile to devote himself to spreading a spiritual message of compassion and peace. Still, he's been drawn into talking about violence since a wave of deadly protests swept through the Tibetan areas of China. Morning Edition's Renee Montaigne sat down with the Dalai Lama to talk about these events in Honolulu, Hawaii. He's been speaking with young people there as part of a visit called Pillars of Peace.
When the Dalai Lama appeared on stage at a student rally at Kailua High School, he was greeted with cheers and a royal Hawaiian welcome. A long line of boys in blue capes chanted. Girls in grass skirts and garlands of bright green leaves danced a graceful hula. On stage, the Dalai Lama told these kids they could be the ones to change the world.
My time, almost now, ending. You, just the beginning. So future on your shoulder.
Kailua High was a natural destination for the Dalai Lama. Over the past decade, it has woven into its curriculum the teachings of the Tibetan leader. It's part of a school-wide initiative aimed at tackling violence, ethnic tension, and bullying. Outside, as the trade winds blew across the campus, we talked to the teacher who developed the program. Amber Strong Makayao said the school was able to fund the initiative thanks to federal dollars made available after the massacre at Columbine High School.
What the Dalai Lama brings us back to is what is the root cause of this violence? And he's talking about fear and frustration and anger. And so I think what we're trying to do is teach the students how to work through those issues so we don't even get to this place of violence. And that's what living and talking, using dialogue and thinking critically in a community of inquiry where you're connecting to one another, I think that's what it's teaching is compassion.
Christian Kele'ikoma is a senior who transferred to Kailua High as a sophomore. He found a dramatic difference from his old school.
Because there's a lot of bullying and stuff over there. But when I came over here, I was very shocked. People were really nice. The teachers try to put that kind of perspective into the students over here. Our classes, they have certain sayings on our classes, is to spread the aloha. What you give is what you're going to get back.
When I sat down with the Dalai Lama, he pointed out that bullying is global. Countries can be bullies, which is how many Tibetans view China. In recent years, China has cracked down hard on its Tibetan areas, putting Chinese bureaucrats in charge of monasteries, detaining monks and even religious pilgrims, part of what the Dalai Lama has characterized as a cultural genocide. At least 30, mostly young Tibetans, have set themselves on fire in protest over the past year, many calling for the return of the Dalai Lama. Why is this happening right at this moment?
In order to know, you have to study last 1,000 years history.
It's a complicated story.
Tibet.
Yes.
Now, semi-cultural revolution is returning.
Mao's cultural revolution
from
the 60s.
That's right. Everybody
coming
knows.
To Tibet now.
Yes. Yeah. You see, things become worse and worse and worse. So therefore, the sad events is just symptoms of last several decades, their mistake. The local authorities, Chinese authority, out of their fear, they carry very unrealistic, suppressive sort of policy. I always tell my Chinese friend, policy must be realistic. In order to carry realistic policy, you have to find the reality. They say that, but practically just opposite. They ignore the reality and they impose their own wish. That's the problem.
You know, China is expected to name a new leader in the coming year. And the current vice president, Xi Jinping, that's who it would be. His father was not only an influential party member, although at times he was purged, but he was quite moderate towards Tibet. And I understand that he was once seen wearing a gold watch that you had given him, and that also he carried a picture of the Dalai Lama. So did you knew him?
I know.
But this would be, you know, we have heard so much about Vice President Xi Jinping coming to America, and his father was an admirer of yours. One might think that he would be maybe more helpful when he comes to power for Tibet. Mm. But in fact, he's been quite harsh. Maybe it is the son going against the father.
just speculation. The one fact, the present Prime Minister, Wen Jiabao, last few years, he expressed China need political reform. He even mentioned China need Western style of democracy. So seems to Wen Jiabao very sincere about reforming political system of thinking. So next leadership may build a new policy, but too early to say. Everything secretive, secrecy. So very difficult to predict.
Given this unrest at the moment, people know very well that you have said that you cannot go back to Tibet because there are certain things that China needs to agree to. You've agreed to many things. But have you considered just going back? What would happen?
I always make clear, firstly, I'm a human being. On that level, I fully committed to promote deeper human value in order to achieve happier humanity. There are two sort of different kinds of Tibetan sort of expression. Older people, they simply express they wish I return as soon as possible before they die. More younger people, more serious people, they always send me message. Under present circumstances, they feel Dalai Lama should remain outside. So Dalai Lama can represent the wishes of Tibetan people in free country. So, of course, Chinese people, we very much respect their culture. But the present system is something now actually outdated system. Things are changing. Things are changing. So, long run, I'm full of optimism. Things are changing.
The spiritual leader of Tibet, the 14th Dalai Lama, speaking with us here in Honolulu.
And of course, that's her own Renee Montagne. It's NPR News.
Catholic parishioners in the Cleveland Diocese were overjoyed today to hear that Bishop Richard Lennon has decided to reopen their closed churches. This morning, he said his decision came after a prayerful and thoughtful process.
During these Easter days, I often think of Jesus' first words as he appeared to the apostles after rising from the dead. Peace be with you. I now say, it's time for peace and unity in the Diocese of Cleveland.
With those words, Bishop Lennon said he would not appeal an extraordinary Vatican decree that came last month, which reversed the closing of 12 parishes in the Cleveland Diocese. I'm joined now by a parishioner of one of those churches that will be reopened, Patricia Schulte Singleton. She's leader of the Save St. Pat's Committee. Welcome to the program, Patricia.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
When did your church, when did St. Patrick's close its doors?
The last Mass was May 30th, 2010.
So just coming up on 2 years.
Correct.
And you appealed to the Vatican, you won that, and now Bishop Lennon has said he's not going to fight the Vatican's ruling on that. What was your reaction to what he said today?
Relief. A little bit apprehensive and stunned. It all kind of happened so quickly this morning, but just a sense of relief.
It does seem that what's going on there in Cleveland is what the Catholic Church has faced in a number of parts of the country, financial hardship, population that's shifted, smaller congregations, fewer priests for the ministry, and the grouping into fewer churches is seen as making them stronger overall, less of them but stronger. Do you see the logic to that?
In some respect, yes. But in our neighborhood, we were a vital part of the neighborhood. We had outreach programs. You know, we contributed to the neighborhood. I've been there since 1848, and it was not a good discernment to suppress us via merger and to close our parish doors.
Bishop Lennon did say today that each of these 12 parishes that were closed is going to have to show active membership and the financial wherewithal, he said, to sustain themselves. How big a hurdle do you think that'll be?
For some parishes, it might be difficult. many parishioners felt very disenfranchised, if you will, and it moved on to other parishes or actually left the faith in general. I think, on the other hand, too, that there's parishioners out there, and I know they're from St. Pat's, are ready to start anew and are excited to start again.
Ms. Singleton, where have you been going since St. Patrick's closed?
Well, I've been going to different parish churches to fulfill my obligation, Sunday obligation. So I've been what they quote-unquote called a Roman Catholic.
Roman Catholic, Roman around.
Yes, going to different churches to celebrate Mass.
And how did that feel? Did that feel like home?
No, not at all. You know, there was always a want to be back with my community, and it won't be long before that will happen, and to pick up where we left off and do even better than we were before.
I've been talking with Patricia Schulte Singleton. She's leader of the Save St. Pat's Committee. St. Patrick's is one of 12 churches in the Cleveland Diocese that were closed and will now be reopened under orders from the Vatican. Patricia, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Charles Colson died today at the age of 80. Colson served time in prison for his role in the Watergate scandal and later became an influential evangelical Christian. He traversed from being one of the nation's most despised men to a hero of Christian conservatives. Here's NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty with more.
Charles Colson was a 38-year-old lawyer when he found his political calling, working for President Richard Nixon. As special counsel to the president, Colson quickly gained a reputation, says Michael Cromarty at the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
In the Nixon White House, he was a person who said he'd run over his grandmother to get the president reelected. He was known as ruthless, calculating. He knew how to play power politics and play it rough and nasty and dirty.
Cromarty, who worked for Colson in the late 1970s, says those tactics got the White House lawyer into trouble. Prosecutors charged him in several Watergate cases, including the burglary of the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. About this time, Colson later told the Christian Broadcasting Network, he visited a friend who wanted him to turn to Jesus. Colson was unpersuaded, but as he was leaving, he was overcome.
I think about that night in the driveway when I cried out to God and I realized for the first time what a sinner I was, and I realized that Christ died on the cross for my sins. And I felt so free, but so grateful to God that ever since I'll do anything God calls me to do.
When word got out about Colson's conversion, says biographer Jonathan Aitken, people scoffed.
The world of Washington and probably the general world thought that this was some sort of Colson public relations trick. But, of course, time has told a very different story about that.
In 1974, Colson pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice and served 7 months in federal prison. He later said prison life humbled him and confirmed his new direction.
I used to look at life from the top looking down. In prison, you learn to look at life from the underside, and you see people hurting and suffering, and it has changed my whole perspective.
Soon after his release, Colson started Prison Fellowship, which served prisoners and their families. It became the world's largest prison ministry, and now it's in more than 100 countries. But not everyone is impressed. Barry Lynn, who heads Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, has criticized Prison Fellowship. In fact, he sued it and won for pressuring prisoners to convert to Christianity by offering them better conditions. Lynn says Colson never changed his methods, just his boss.
Sadly, when he went from being Richard Nixon's hatchet man, he turned into a man who thought he was God's hatchet man, literally turning these very formidable political skills that he had in the service of very far-right religious and political agendas.
Whatever one thought of Colson, he had influence. His books, including Born Again, were bestsellers. His radio commentaries, called Breakpoint, reached millions. Colson always kept his hand in politics. Michael Cromarty says one of his biggest achievements was born of a friendship with Father Richard John Newhouse. In the 1990s, the two men began to meet to end the historic hostility between evangelical Protestants and Catholics.
And they said, you know, instead of warring against each other, we have so many of the same concerns on religious values and moral values and social values. Why can't we put together a theological statement? That statement marked a real milestone in evangelical Catholic relations that lives on to this day.
Biographer Jonathan Aitken says in the end, Colson's biggest legacy probably won't be his books or his prison ministry.
I think Chuck Colson's legacy is, above all, the story of his life.
It's a story about a bad man turned good through grace, says Michael Cromarty, which made him a force to be reckoned with.
He took the dynamism he carried into politics and brought it into the larger world of evangelical Christianity and became, next to Billy Graham, probably one of the leading spokespersons for evangelical Christianity in America today.
And like Billy Graham, Colson lived without scandal ever since his conversion. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.